Hey, all you Know Better fans, just a quick heads up that next week's show is going to be a bit of a spoiler cast. Jeff and I are going to talk in depth about the book The Martian by Anthony Weir. If you haven't heard about it yet, it's basically Robinson Crusoe meets Castaway on Mars. If you haven't read it yet but have it on your radar, you've got this week to do it, and you really should. It's a fantastic book. It's almost 100% plausible. We have almost all of this technology today that's described in the book. If you like hard sci-fi, good writing, and clever problem solving, you'll love The Martian. And we're going to talk about it next week. Until then, enjoy episode 4, have a very happy Thanksgiving, and good luck if you brave the wiles of retaildom to secure your holiday deals.
Hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell and Jeff Janey.
Welcome to another episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. I am Jeff Janey.
And I'm Jacob Cazell.
So we got a few things to discuss today, Jacob.
That we do. It seems like there's always more to discuss than we have time to discuss it. And I've got a couple of quick updates. So the plumbing fiasco from last week, it turns out that I have to destroy my entire yard. The plumbing company came back out today. They part of the deal we had was they would come back and put a camera down the drain. And he got the camera about 25 feet down the sewer line and literally couldn't put the camera through anymore. And this camera is about an inch and a half in diameter and it wouldn't go through the root ball. And he said, yeah, you probably aren't going to make it 6 more weeks. So good luck with that. we've got 65 feet of yard and 8-inch clay pipe that has to come out probably right before Christmas.
Yay.
The only good news, knock on wood, is my brother-in-law has access to heavy equipment, and he is going to come and help me heavy equipment that out. So instead of it costing thousands upon thousands of dollars, I should be able to do it, you know, hopefully all in all good for under $1,000. So that's nice.
Just sounds like a bunch of crap to me.
I highly recommend not having root problems. And the idiots who put the trees in, I don't know if they knew where the sewer line ran, but it's like somebody said, hey, let's put these two trees exactly on top of this clay pipe. I mean, they couldn't be more dead on top of it than if someone planted them as they were covering the pipe back up. It's just insane. All right. So what do you got on the rundown, Jeff?
Okay, how about update to the Title II discussion that we had last week?
Okay, well, this is interesting. So just the other day, broadcasters got a court order to stop consumers from learning how much cable companies are paying for content. The FCC is reviewing the mergers between Comcast and Time Warner and between AT&T and DirecTV. And part of that, the FCC intended to make information available about the deals that those companies make with the broadcasters so that, you know, that information was out there. And the broadcasters went to court and sued to have that information held back. And as of November 17th, actually received a stay from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which prevents the FCC from releasing the information. So as the competition dwindles, as the companies merge, consumers actually get less information about how badly they're getting ripped off than they did before.
Okay. Yeah. An interesting side note on in my opinion, Comcast Time Warner. You know, I don't know that I necessarily have as big a problem with the merger from a content provider. The biggest problem that I have with Comcast in general is that they are also a content creator. And I think that lends itself to really, really big problems with when we start talking about net neutrality. You know, how is Comcast not being fiscally responsible to its shareholders by trying to make their content more readily and easily available over their network? And I would really like to see, if nothing else, if you're going to let this merger go through, for Comcast to have to break out that content portion into a separate company.
Well, I don't think that the FCC is going to ever show any kind of backbone and require that, because their leadership is, you know, puppets of industry who come and go from the telcos and from the cable companies and from the lobbying companies. Nobody's ever going to make them do that or hold them accountable for that. I don't know how you make that happen. I don't see it happening with the current political climate. And unless there is just something incredibly egregious that happens that forces consumers to demand that that happens, I don't see it happening willingly. The industry isn't going to self-regulate in that direction. Something interesting I just heard is, so 3.9 million people had commented to the FCC on the issue of net neutrality. Prior to that, that is now the most commented on thing for the FCC. And prior to that, can you guess what the prior most commented thing to the FCC was?
Yes, I do. That would be Janet Jackson's Nipplegate.
That's right. The nip slip from what it's probably been 12 years now. Was that, it was 2002, 2003?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
At least 10 years ago. And so we just.
Back when we would have cared about seeing Janet Jackson's nipple.
So we just don't care anymore, and
no.
But no, not about that, but I mean just about net neutrality in general. The thing that actually worries me a little bit as a customer sort of caught in the middle of this is that and I know you're an Xfinity customer too, Jeff, but where we live, we are getting sold off to I believe it's Charter as part of the deal that Comcast is making to try and get the FCC to approve their merger. They're letting go of a lot of their franchises, and our franchise is one of them. So who knows what kind of service, if this does happen, which I think is a done deal. I'd have to check on that 100%, but I think that they are in the process of selling our market. What are we going to get from Charter?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm looking at it as a possible win for me, because I am currently in like a, I don't know, year and 3 months and change left agreement on my home security system. And my hope is that when this Charter thing goes through, they don't have home security. So maybe I'll just be out of my contract and get to keep my handy dandy equipment and then go with who I want to.
Yeah, but will that equipment work with any other providers, or is it locked down to a Comcast?
Well, the tablet itself will not work. You know, the main hub of what the security system is won't work. But the other items that are on it are Zigbee related.
Oh.
So I'll be able to use that with a different, you know, home automation base, which in the grand scheme of things will work out better for me, because Comcast has been slow to adopt new items into their home security repertoire, i.e. I can get a Zigbee light, I can get a Zigbee front door lock, but I can't attach them to my current base because Comcast locks that portion down.
So at some point you could conceivably get a new hub and tie all of those other open components into that hub and expand it from there.
Yeah, that would be my ideal situation, yes.
Just in time for CES in January, where the rumors are Apple is going to be promoting HomeKit heavily, and all of that will probably be obsolete.
Yay!
Well, and it's interesting. I don't know what the contracts look like for Comcast, and specifically for the home security piece. I know that when cell phone providers and wireless providers make changes to their service and change termination fees and whatnot, you actually can use that as an out of your contract. I would assume that you probably have language in there that says the same thing. So you may have an out if you really wanted to get out. I don't know. Are there insurance company discounts for having monitored security systems and whatnot? The out may not be worth the discount. I have no idea.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into it. The biggest thing for me, I'm just really disappointed in the, you know, when I signed up for this, oh, we're going to get locks, we're going to get garage door openers, we're going to get this, we're going to get that. And they've got a grand total of absolutely zero
yeah.
new items since I signed up for it. So I don't know why that shocks me in any sense of the word, but I definitely will want a protected system, you know, even with or without the discounts. I'll want some kind of monitored system, but ultimately, obviously, I don't think it can be Comcast if they're not going to be doing business in this area anymore. And
no, not unless they break that service off and sell it to an ADP or, you know, SecureLink or somebody like that, which, I, you know, the devil you know is worse than the devil you don't.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, the one reason I went with Comcast in the first place is how much cheaper a monthly service fee it was than like an ADT. So
yeah,
from that standpoint, that the service has been great in that it isn't, you know, all the money per month like an ADT is. But yeah, I don't, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. I'm kind of a little worried about what I'm going to see happen.
Yeah. Well, segueing for just a second, this, it's interesting, but like several years ago, I, a friend of the family had gotten into selling alarm systems and doing the monitoring. And it turns out that there is, it's like jewelry and diamonds. There is an insane markup on monitoring. And he was doing the same thing where he would go in and sell monitoring and he would come in slightly under an ADT or a CenturyLink or any of those who were charging, you know, $35 or $40 a month. And he'd come in at, you know, $29 a month and, you know, still the same 3-year contract and people would love it because they saved themselves a few bucks a month. And he could even, you know, quote unquote, work deals to get people out of their contracts. But the dirty little secret is he was paying like $2 a month for bulk monitoring. It's almost free. The problem is you and I can't go get it on the open market unless you're willing to commit to buying 100 accounts. So the cost of monitoring and almost all of the systems will send overflow to these bulk monitoring call centers. So yes, if you have an ADT system and they're not overwhelmed, your call should go to an ADT call center, but it's possible that it spills over to, you know, one of these bulk call centers and it costs next to nothing. So the fact that we pay these absurd rates for home monitoring, it's kind of a sucker's game. Unfortunately, there's nothing that the average Joe can do to get around it.
Yeah, that, great.
I solved that by having a Rottweiler and shotguns.
Well, you know the kind of dogs I have, so they're not helping out much.
Maybe if you got some more, you could just like throw them like projectiles.
Maybe a slingshot thing.
Yeah, little dogs are good for something, and that is being the projectile in a David and Goliath type sling.
Keep your feet warm, too.
Well, yeah, and I suppose that just built-in slippers. But
that's correct.
It does drive me a little nuts that these companies are saying things. And in fact, one of the quotes that I read was that the FCC's order is, quote, arbitrary and capricious and in violation of the Trade Secrets Act. So the broadcasters can't have it both ways. And I don't know, you know, this Title II stuff is starting to get more attention, certainly in the realm of the internet and the geeks, but I want to hope that maybe it percolates up to a little bit higher level of attention, especially with some of the attention that shows like Last Week Tonight with John Oliver have focused on it. You know, the Daily Show has focused on it. I don't know if it'll, you know, reach public consciousness or not, but man, I don't know. It just seems like consumers are really getting bent over.
Yeah, I still hold out hope. I still think the best answer is, at least for the backbone of the internet, that not necessarily the last mile, but that all the other interconnections, I'd like to see that taken over by either state, you know, or federal government, and then lease that out to ISPs and allow that last mile to be the free for all that, you know, free market brings to the table. But
yeah,
I just don't trust, you know, normally I'm a very big capitalist kind of guy, but I don't trust these companies to bring to the consumer what we really should be having. I mean, we're not even in the top 5 for internet speeds in the world, which is just ludicrous. And that's got to change.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because Wheeler himself, the chairman of the FCC, has pretty much admitted – well, not pretty much. He has admitted that Americans have no choice. There is really no competition out there, and saying that the vast majority – and I don't have the exact percentage of Americans who have access to what they call very high speed internet, which is they're classifying as over 25 megabits per second – the vast majority of people have one choice, And that's typically the cable company in town. And, you know, when you only have one choice, that's no choice at all. And those companies are able to use their size to just hammer on the content providers. And, you know, that's really scary because now that I'm a content provider with this podcast, admittedly, I don't think that anybody's going to hold me hostage and make me pay a ransom to get, you know, what I have to say out to people. But it certainly could go that way. And the bigger podcasts have a lot to be worried about in that respect. You know, the people who are pulling in a 500,000 listeners an episode, it's really scary. Now, the other side of that, which you say, you know, nationalize it and make it a national utility. Then do you run into issues of, you know, well, then there's no swearing because the FCC has said you can't use the seven deadly words on the internet now. And hey, regulation is a blessing and a curse.
You know, I think that if you're going to do that, you have to pass new congressional rules and you have to say that we're going to nationalize this as a utility, but that this will be a free and open internet, that we will not censor content. We will not, you know, that has to be part of new legislation. You can't roll this up into what we currently have because what we currently have is based on telecom technology that's, 30, 40 years old that you can't.
Well, the Common Carrier Act actually goes back to the 1930s. Now, it was updated and revised with the Telecom Act of 96, but those laws really haven't been touched since then.
96.
You're talking 18-year-old laws.
Yeah, that's ancient in technology, right?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, forget about it. I mean, in 1996, 56K was just becoming, you know, a thing that people had. It wasn't even 56K everywhere yet. And gosh, even when I had the internet company in the late 90s, right up until late 99 or early 2000, we had a lot of customers who were in areas that they still couldn't make a 56K connection, even though they had a 56K modem because the infrastructure just wouldn't support it. So yeah, and I mean, 1996 to 2014, that's more than an eternity when it comes to laws governing what technology is capable of.
So let's maybe move on and talk about the latest rulings that we have come up about being compelled to unlock your electronic device based on any kind of biometric passcode, i.e. if you have an iPhone 5S, iPhone 6, iPhone 6 Plus, your Touch ID.
Yeah, and some of the Samsung devices have it now, and I know there's still some laptops out there that have fingerprint readers. And well, technically, you even see places that use biometrics for unlocking doors, and you can buy thumbprint activated door locks, which it's not that far of a logical leap to say, well, if it applies to a smartphone, can it apply to your front door lock if you've got a fingerprint actuated front door?
Yeah, and if you're like super spy dude and you have a retina scanner, yeah, that counts too, right?
Yeah. So for people who may not know, the state of Virginia, judge there, Stephen C. Frucci, just ruled that a suspect can't be compelled to give up a secret code, something they know, because that would be a violation of their Fifth Amendment, but they can be compelled to give up a fingerprint or pieces of DNA, which is something they have. And if you're using the Touch ID on an iOS device or the fingerprint lock on some of the Samsung devices, I don't know what else out there has that. I think there's a few other devices that have it. You could be potentially compelled to unlock your device without a warrant. Now, I think that Frucci's ruling did say that they would need a warrant to look at the data. But the fact that they could potentially force you to unlock it, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, I think that it would be interesting if you're in that situation, and I guess that you think you may have something on your device that would incriminate you. I still wonder if you just said no and you're going to have a warrant to do that. You know, I think ultimately, I find it hard to believe that any of that information that they pulled would be admissible unless they got a warrant. Now, it would be easy for them to get a warrant in the first place. I mean, if you've done something where you have some kind of incriminating information, you're probably up the creek anyway, because it's not that hard to get a warrant. It just takes time.
I feel like in this climate, judges rubber stamp them all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that you could have going for you in that situation is the time thing, because I know with Touch ID, what, you have 48 hours?
Yeah, and your token expires.
I think it'll be interesting. You know, we've already seen Apple and I think Samsung move into a direction of trying to make things more protected, to the point of you have the FBI and NSA saying that Apple needs to back off some. Do you think it would be interesting if Apple created a, hey, if you click your home button four times, it's going to require your passcode?
You know, that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I mean,
obviously, if you power off your device, it has to, you have to put that passcode in, and then at that point, you're not going to be compelled. You can plead the fifth, right?
Yeah, but let's say the police have their eyes on you for whatever reason, and you are completely unaware that they're watching you, and they stop you on your way to work and demand that you unlock your phone. If you're not prepared for that, you may not be in a position where you could power it off.
Yeah, I mean, it takes some time, right, to power off your device. It's not something that you could just do. But, you know, four clicks of the button, yeah, that wouldn't be too hard. And it doesn't seem like that would be super difficult code to put in there. Now, obviously, Apple, you know, I could probably write something to do that, you know, using Tasker in Android right now.
Yeah. Well, so, how many support calls would something like that generate for an Apple II? I mean, they have to balance out, you know, the people who – accidentally hit the button and then it locks it and they are going to complain about it. I don't know. And not being an attorney, those kind of things tend to have wormy language around them where it may not be technically legal to do something like that.
I wonder, can Siri lock your phone to the point of requiring a passcode?
I don't think so. I don't know that for a fact, but
I don't either, but there's another interesting question. If you could say, hey, Siri, lock my phone.
Yeah. You know, I come down on this where I don't necessarily disagree with the ruling, because a fingerprint or a piece of hair, which contains your DNA, I mean, that is a physical attribute of yourself, and there's really nothing that you can do to hide that. But where I do take exception is I feel like this is a case where the intent of the law is not being taken into account. It's the letter of the law. And if I've got my phone or my laptop or my front door locked with the biometric lock, the intent shouldn't be that, well, it's a fingerprint and that is not something you know. It's something you have. We can take it. The intent is it's locked. And, you know, it doesn't matter why, it's locked, and you should not be able to unlock it, period, without, you know, a court order. And frankly, I'll go one further, because if I have a password on something, they cannot, period, full stop, compel me to give that password. Now, they can do a lot of things to entice me to give that password. They can hold me in contempt, but that requires that I'm drug in front of a judge. But they can't make me give that information. They can throw me in a hole until I'm willing to tell it. But, you know, in theory, I could hold out and never give that information out. I don't think that the intent should be with a biometric passcode, you should ever be able to, you know, force someone to key that in, because the intent should be taken into account, not the specific letter of the law.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jacob. I think that, you know, the intent here is not being upheld. And I think it's important to talk about. I mean, the same thing holds true for a laptop. I mean, if you have a password on your laptop, if you have a biometric scan device, which, you know, is on laptops,
yeah,
you shouldn't be compelled to open that up if you so choose. I mean, the Fifth Amendment, the intent there is that you are not going to incriminate yourself. And understanding that we, you know, may have something on our laptop that we wouldn't want people to see, that should be our choice. It's our data. And, you know, I have a hard time with this. I think that, you know, we're becoming more and more of a police state when it comes to some of this stuff. And it scares me a little bit that, you know, in the name of, you know, terrorism or in the name of, well,
yeah, won't somebody think of the children? That was actually an example used by, was it the FBI or the NSA, that you know, these phones being locked down, well, it's going to become the phone of choice of the pedophile, and we won't be able to catch them before they come and defile your child. Well, I mean, that's going to terrify any parent.
Well, yeah, it does terrify you, but the reality is, folks, that this is kind of one of the foundations of our country, and I think that the forefathers knew exactly what they were saying. And
oh, it's an absolute straw man, but it's an effective one.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's easy to get people on your side when you're talking about something that's so egregious to any normal human that it makes you not want to say, well, we should protect those people because we shouldn't, you know. But the reality is that, you know, it's a slippery slope once you start letting people do this kind of stuff. And I wish that you always hear that people are held to the intent of the law. It seems like that's the case when you're talking about an individual person, but when you're talking about the police or the NSA or the FBI, well, it's the letter of the law. We didn't break the letter of the law. Well, tough crap. I mean,
yeah. Well, I think part of it's that saying, you know, when the law's on your side, pound on the law. When the facts are on your side, pound on the facts. And when neither's on your side, pound on the table. Well, and it's a slippery slope. Okay, so pedophiles using encryption so that they can hide their activities, bad, and they shouldn't be protected. And if you use this system or endorse this system, then you're just enabling the pedophiles, and nobody wants that. And everybody can agree that, you know, that is a horrible thing. But where do you draw the line? So what if it's someone who is just horribly racist? Well, that's a terrible thing, but there's nothing illegal about it. You know, where do you draw those lines? And what happens when the thing that you don't necessarily want to be out there in public, let's say that you do, you know, I don't know, bad poetry, and you'd be mortified if people found out about that. Well, you know, you should have, I mean, there's nothing that I have on my computers that's illegal that I'm aware of. But at the same time, I don't necessarily want to upload the contents of my hard drive to the internet and say, here's everything on there, dig through it. So, yeah, I don't know. I really think that the courts have gotten this one wrong. And while I don't disagree with the ruling that you should be able to take DNA from someone to see if it matches for a crime, if you're using something biometric to lock something up, that's different.
So another topic that we had talked about bringing up is just kind of taking a look back at the last three shows that we've done. And you know, interestingly enough, and I don't know that this should come as a surprise to very many people, right? But we almost implicitly talk about mobile technology.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that that's super surprising. And one thing that I got to thinking about, if you really look at it, a lot of people will pop down $200 on an iPhone, you know, with a 2-year contract and think, well, I'm getting something for $200. But the reality is that a lot of times that iPhone is probably the most expensive computing device that they own.
Oh, because by far.
In reality, that's probably a $650 minimum device. And, you know, no one buys a $650 laptop anymore. They're out trying to buy the cheapest thing you can get on a Black Friday deal for $199 and, you know, hope that it lasts them a year.
Well, and that's a good point, because I've got a lot of people that come to me and say, I want to buy a laptop. What should I buy? And I say, well, you should look at a MacBook Air. Okay. What's that going to run me? $1,000. I want to spend $250. Well, then you're not going to get something that you're going to be particularly happy with. You know, you can get a laptop for that, but it's not going to be the greatest build, and you might have problems with it. And you know, do you want something that you're not going to have an issue with, or do you want something that you're going to have to fight with from time to time?
And the hinge is going to break after 3 months. And yeah, I run into the same situation. And, but anyway, but mobile tech, I mean, I think that the reality is that how far are we away until the laptop, the desktop are irrelevant for the majority of people? You know, when computers first started, no one needed a home computer. That idea of a home computer is absolutely idiocracy.
Yeah.
And we may have come full circle on that. The idea of a home computer may be idiocracy at this point.
Yeah, you know, you say how long until we're at that point, and I would argue that we've already begun down, you know, that path, and the door is darn near closed behind us. You know, I look at, like my parents. They have a laptop and they do use it, but they also have a tablet and they both have smartphones. And I would have never in a million years thought that I would be texting with my parents. I remember a few years ago, you know, the stereotypical, this texting doesn't make any sense. Just pick the phone up when you talk, call someone when you want to talk to. And my parents both text now. My mother plays Candy Crush, for crying out loud. You know, they travel and they post pictures from their phones to Facebook and they get on their tablet. And frankly, that's good enough. And, you know, here in my own household, outside of work, my girlfriend, she doesn't use a laptop. I do. I'm old school, but a lot of her family is the same way. They use mobile devices. A lot of the people I know, friends, are the same way. They use mobile devices, and that is their primary platform. Now, whether that's because of cost or convenience or just that's where everything has moved to, I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, I kind of feel like, you know, the default path is going to be, well, you buy a $150 Chromebook or you buy an inexpensive tablet. And only if you have a really exceptional need should you look at buying a laptop. I think the PC makers, the budget PC makers need to be terrified. I think there's always a market at the higher end for professionals and people who truly do need, you know, or want those devices. But at the low end, I think it's gone. And I would have never bet 10 years ago that I would be having that conversation.
Yeah, I don't think I would have 10 years ago. I don't think that it surprises me now. These mobile devices, whether or not you're talking about a phone, you're talking about a tablet, there are so much more personal devices. There are things that we hold, that we touch, that are close to us, right?
Yeah.
It's not something off on a desk that you go to a special room to use, or, you know, even with a laptop, it's not something that takes up entire space of your lap. It's, you know, you're going to have to keep it there. You know, with a tablet, I can pick it up, use it, put it down. It's easy. It's more intimate. It's right there with me. So I think that switch, that move is just makes a lot of sense. And I think the idea of a wearable technology, and that's where everyone's going, is to even try to make these things even more personal. Now, I'm not convinced that a wristwatch or Google Glass is the answer, but I think there's steps in that progression of, you know, try to even get it more intimate, try to get it to be, you know, closer to, you know, that personal assistant type device that can just answer our questions, that can give us the information that we want right away. And I think that, you know, if we could ever get to a device that didn't look any different than eyeglasses, that would project information, that would have a long battery life, that would do all those magical things, you know, sign me up. I don't think Google Glass is that. I'm definitely am not convinced on the watch thing, although as a watch, and if you position something as a watch with added features, I can still see a benefit to that. And I know I've been a little more bullish on those wearable devices than you have, but when I look at a, you know, upcoming Apple Watch at, you know, $500, I'm breaking that down into, okay, you know, if I were to buy a really nice Casio watch, I'm going to spend probably $100. And if I'm going to buy a Fitbit, I'm going to spend another $150. And boy, you know, to spend a couple $100 more and get some notifications on that and have some really nice styling and the, you know, social status that comes with having the latest and greatest Apple gadget, which I admit I'm a slave to just the same as anyone else, or people that are willing to admit it. You know, it doesn't seem like that out of line to me, but ultimately I don't think that's the intimate device that we're looking for. You know, I'm looking for those built-in things, or as you said that one time, the screen that I can just open up in between my hands and consume some data, and then it rolls up into a nice little pen-shaped thing I put in my pocket. You know, I'm ready for those things, but
yeah, no, I mean, all of those things I think are on the horizon, but certainly a lot of what you just said requires that next leap in technology that we're not there yet. To your point about, you know, it doesn't surprise me to see that we're going this way with, you know, moving towards mobile. I agree. It doesn't surprise me. I think what surprises me is how fast that transition has happened for the average person. And outside of, you know, work, the average person is moving mobile only, or, you know, the vast majority of their computing time is mobile. And that's happening a lot faster than I would have predicted. It's interesting to see how fast the embrace and adoption of these smart devices has been. It's not that I'm not bullish on wearables. I'm skeptical of the utility with the current technology, simply because they are limited. Battery tech hasn't kept up yet. And while we can keep making things smaller and cramming more functionality and more features into a little tiny package, it's not quite there yet. And I feel like a lot of the smartwatches and the Google Glass are still looking for, it's a solution looking for a problem. Now, I think there's a lot of potential. And when you break it down, like you said, you know, a nice digital watch is going to cost me $50 to $100, and a fitness tracker is going to cost me $100 to $150. And, you know, notifications add some value, which, you know, is, you have to put your own price on it. But when you break it down like that, it does make it a lot more compelling to say, well, if I'm spending $250 or $350 or $500 on a device, it makes that pill a lot less bitter to swallow. But it's also technology that, you know, is going to be obsolete in 18 months or 24 months. And is there really a market of people who are going to, you know, buy that every year and a half or 2 years, or heck, even every year, like some people have fallen into with cell phones? Maybe there is, but I still think that's premature.
Well, there certainly isn't going to be very much of a market for $5,000 to $7,000 gold one, right?
Well, maybe there will if they can trade it back in for, you know, $5,000 and apply that towards the next.
Well, there's going to have to be something like that, because there's just no way. I mean, you know, gold is a precious commodity, and we are I can't see someone popping down $5,000. And I really think that you're looking at $5,000. That's my prediction for the gold watch.
Yeah, for an 18 karat gold body, sure. I mean, not only are you paying for the watch and the material, which definitely has intrinsic value, but you're also paying for the brand. And there's, you're paying for the ability to say, I have the Apple Watch or edition Apple Watch. Don't underestimate the rich people who have way more money than common sense. I mean, I don't think they'll sell 100 million of them, but it wouldn't surprise me that it moves a decent number of units. I think it's going to be surprising to everyone how many they sell.
It'll surprise me if they sell very many. Maybe that's some of my Midwestern frugality coming through, which I have very little, by the way.
You know, everything is relative. And, you know, I've had people in my life before who, you know, the thought of something that that my family has done and likes to do, not every week or every month, but a time or two a year, we like to go out to a nice restaurant and have a nice dinner. And it's not unusual in those circumstances for it to be $70 or $80 or sometimes even $100 a person, depending on where we go. And, you know, it's an experience. But there are also other people in my life who look at that as an inconceivable thing to do, that's just not even in the wheelhouse of what, who would do that? Who would go spend $100 on dinner? I can go to Ponderosa, and for $12.95, I can get a steak and all you can eat buffet. And so I feel like, you know, as with everything, there are people who $7,000 for a watch, they've got that in folding money in their dresser drawer. I'm not one of those people, but it's not that far-fetched to think that there's a lot of people out there like that. Like I said, I think the numbers will end up surprising us on how many they sell, because it's a status symbol, and Apple has definitely always been about status. And, you know, this isn't a status symbol that just anybody can get. Yeah, you might be the first guy on your block that has the newest iPhone or the newest iMac, but, you know, guess what? Everybody can have that. if you go spend $7,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 on a watch, there's not that many people that are going to have that. And there are a lot of people, I think more than you think, that, you know, that means something to them. Not to me, but to them.
Okay. And I just have to say, I don't think that means what you think it means. Sorry. Princess Bride Tourette's.
That's a great movie.
I can't hear the word inconceivable and not say that. That's something that just has to happen. Even if I didn't interject it at that point, it was driving me nuts.
Just you got to scratch that itch, huh? Well, and I think it's interesting how fast things have changed, though, because, you know, it's when was the iPhone released? 2007. So we really are talking 7 years, and the whole world has just gone away from big computing. And, well, not big computing, because I guess that's now the cloud.
Correct. Yeah.
And all of that heavy horsepower lives in the cloud. I mean, we are at some level moving towards Star Trek. I mean, we have tricorders and it interfaces with powerful systems in the cloud that, you know, the ship's computer that does the heavy lifting. And
well, if you think about it, you know, everything that's old is new again, right?
Yeah.
You know, we had mainframe with terminals, and that's basically what the cloud is, right?
It is.
The computing power lives somewhere else. You just access that information from your dumb terminal. I mean,
absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting is, as we move this direction, who are the people that are going to be the next generation of the keepers of the system? Is that going to become arcane again, like it was, you know, in the world of mainframes, where you had the operators and it was a specialized skill and the vast majority of people had no clue how to do that? I mean, today technology is very pervasive and, you know, there's a lot of people who understand the back end and how to build these systems. But, you know, we're having a whole generation of kids come up where, because of these proprietary systems and because of these mobile systems, they're much more locked down. It's a lot harder to tinker. I mean, that's really how I taught myself, you know, computing was tearing the computer apart and putting it back together and looking at all of these pieces in a much more open fashion. And that doesn't exist as much today. So it makes me wonder what the future is going to bring as far as, you know, who becomes the maintainers in 20 years, who keeps it running.
That is a question that I don't know the answer to. I don't think there's very many from a hardware perspective, right? There aren't a lot of people that are in that are at least as a sexy profession anymore, right? Everything's on the software side, development.
Now, but that's always cyclical. But, you know, I look at it as, okay, so at least I can wrap my head around taking components and taking small subsystems and assembling them into a bigger system that works together, both from a hardware and a software standpoint. But I look at it as even take a step up from that and, you know, look at the incredible intricacy in chip design. And as the software does more and more, you know, the hardware is got to keep up with the software. And we keep finding new ways to extend Moore's law and put more power into smaller spaces. And, you know, that's already at the level of voodoo. That is not even within the world of IT. It's a tiny, tiny percentage of people who understand chip fabrication.
Well, chip fabrication is magic. I mean, for all intents and purposes, that is magic. There's nothing about that I understand at all. And I'm not a stupid person.
Right. It is. And, you know, it's not that a person does it on paper or in their head anymore. They obviously use expert systems to help with that. Do we get to the point where, because we have to make these expert systems so much more powerful and so much more capable because of what, you know, the limits of the ability to hold a design that has 5 trillion transistors, you know, I mean, I don't know that we'll ever reach to those levels, but you're already talking billions of transistors in chip design. Well, what happens when you cross that next order of magnitude? And now you're talking trillions of transistors. That's beyond the capability of the human mind to keep in mind. So we have to design these systems. So is a true AI does it grow out of our building to continue building? And who are the people that, build that? You've been listening to Deep Thoughts with Jeff and Jacob. I mean, it's very, very esoteric, but you know, at the same time that there is a lot of that magic, like you said, that powers the infrastructure that your average person, heck, even your average technologist, they may know about it. I know chip designers exist and chip fabs exist. Put me in one and I would not, you might as well put a chimp in there. I'm going to do absolutely no better. And I'll probably get frustrated and start flinging my poo around too.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Is there anything else that you want to talk about tonight, Jacob?
You know, I do. There's two things that I want to touch on, and maybe we can do them quickly. I know we're coming up on about 45 minutes. I really want to talk, just even if it's for a minute, about so just this week, New York City has given its blessing for the public schools to implement Chromebooks. And I want to touch on that for two things. One, I know that you have direct experience within your family of having a kid that is in a program where they've got Chromebooks handed out. And two, something I was thinking about is that, you know, right now, from a productivity software standpoint, Microsoft Office is still the king of the hill. I mean, Excel, let's face it, Word doesn't really even matter anymore, but you know, Excel is, you know, sort of that gold standard product, and that's what everybody knows. And, you know, when I was in high school, heck, even up really until pretty recently, it was always, well, you found a way to end up with Office at home, and that was what your kids used. And, you know, maybe it wasn't completely legitimate, but I think Microsoft, you know, to the extent that they could, turn the other way, because they knew that you're grooming, you know, an upcoming generation. And, you know, like Apple was so successful in the 70s and 80s with, you know, integrating tightly with education, Microsoft has done the same to try and make sure that the workforce is continually being refreshed with people that know their products. And as the schools move away from, you know, the Microsoft and the PC, and they go to tablets and they go to Chromebooks, you know, Google's apps for education is becoming extremely compelling, and there are dedicated Blackboard systems. I really wonder, you know, does Microsoft Office become obsolete in 10 years because, you know, the kids that are coming out of the public education don't, that's not what their go-to application is.
So I think that if Microsoft had any, you know, gumption, any direction, that they would start handing this stuff out for free, including Office 365, OneDrive, at least at the education level, because I think that there's twofold reasons that you see schools going to Chromebooks. And the high school went to, in the town that my kids go to school, went to everyone gets a Chromebook deal. And that's nice from a hardware situation, because not everyone has computers at home. And so that gets, you know, that device into everybody's hands. But I think more importantly, the collaboration that's available with Google Docs and the ability for the students to just save that document out in a shared folder that the teacher says, when you're done with your paper, you save it out in the shared folder, and that's turning it in. So you don't have to print anything out. You know, you don't have to put something in this box and get a chance that it gets lost somewhere. I mean, I think that in and of itself is even a more compelling reason that the schools are going to this type of thing. You roll that in with the fact that, you know, Google's basically giving them their mail backbone that school system's using for free. I mean, if Microsoft wants to continue to have that user base that's going to use things, you know, when they get out and start their own companies, well, you know, why would you put that infrastructure in there to have an Outlook, to, you know, to have Office? I mean, those are expensive propositions, and I just don't see people doing that. And it has been extremely useful. You know, even on things that you don't even think about, my daughter, who's in middle school, is trying out for Allstate. And part of doing an Allstate is that you do an audition tape. So you tape, you know, some couple of pieces of music that she's been practicing, and that gets sent in. Well, you know, right now they're practicing those, and they're creating a tape, and the band director wants to listen to them, and he makes notes and gives it back to them so that they can, you know, adjust their performance and try to get better. Well, you know, last night, my daughter was like, you know, Dad, is there anything I can use? And, you know, I fired up the podcasting microphone and she recorded it and we saved that file out to a WAV file. We uploaded it to Google Drive. We shared it with her band teacher and he listened to it last night.
Yeah.
And made notes. And I mean, those are the kind of things where, you know, Google right now is just beating the pants off Microsoft. And, you know, it's a no-brainer for the school system because ultimately they're paying nothing for the software, nothing for the email infrastructure. And, you know, they got a grant for all the Dell hardware that they handed out. So they're not paying anything for this program. And it is extremely beneficial to the students.
Well, you know, and one of the things that the Google collaboration tools make easy is that they make it easy. And while the Microsoft tools are incredibly powerful, SharePoint is not easy to use. And, you know, Excel, I consider myself a power user. You can do amazing things with Excel, but 9 times out of 10, Google Spreadsheet is plenty for what I need.
Well, you can do so much more with Excel, but you're talking about, you know, 3 or 4% of the people that actually know how to use those things in Excel. The majority of people are using Excel to have a column and do a sum, and boy, they might get fancy and do an average or a variance column or something. But come on, people aren't doing pivot tables and lookups and I mean, that's just not the norm. And
that's what the Google tools make so easy. I mean, you know, a good example, we use the Google apps to do all of our collaboration. We're not sitting in the same room and recording this. You know, we live an hour apart from each other and it's completely seamless. I can open a show notes document at work when I've got a few minutes. I can look over it. I can, you know, get it on my phone. I can get it at home. It's a complete no-brainer. It exists everywhere. I need it to be as long as I have a connection to the internet. And it's just ridiculously simple. And it works so well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the collaboration portion, I mean, my son's worked on group projects this year where, you know, you used to, oh, we have to have a meeting and we have to get together and talk about it. And they're opening a doc and they're all working in it at the same time. And I mean, geez, is that nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's amazing. And Microsoft is full of smart people. I mean, I think it's very premature to say, you know, put a fork in them, they're done. And Satya Nadella is, he certainly seems to be embracing the fact that the desktop is for the majority of people over and, you know, they're pushing to the cloud and they're, you know, doing some amazing things with their Azure, cloud platform tools. And, you know, I know that they're going to be a player for a long, long time. I wonder how they're going to fit in when they're not the tools that people know by default. And, you know, that can really make or break the, you know, the ubiquity of a company's products. And, you know, Office is still, I think, currently their breadwinner when it comes to their, you know, the lion's share of their profits. So it'll be interesting to see if they can transition that to, you know, making the lion's share of their profits through cloud services where, you know, maybe that doesn't hurt so bad that it's not coming from, you know, Office and OS sales.
Good points.
So I know we're coming up on an hour. We can, push the other topics to next week. They're not, you know, certainly not, that timely. I don't know if you want to jump in and do the things we love segment or I can go first and jump in because I have a great one. What I love this week is I love it more than just this week, but that's what I'm talking about this week. It's the Logitech MK270 wireless mouse and keyboard. And the reason I love it is it's $20 for both a wireless mouse and a wireless keyboard. Now, I'm not terribly picky about my mouse and keyboard. I like wireless units because it makes moving them out of the way easy. If I've got to, you know, work on a project on my desk, you can throw it off the desk. You don't have to worry about, you know, stacking it and balancing it on top of things. The Logitech stuff is reliable. I've never had a problem with Logitech keyboards and mice. And did I mention it's $20? That's on Amazon. It might be a little bit more if you buy it, you know, at a brick and mortar, but $20. You need one. The other thing that I really, really like about it is, the keyboard, I think, takes 2 AAA batteries and will last for 24 months is what Logitech says. And the mouse takes 2 AA batteries and lasts for 12 months. I've had mine at home since March. So, what is that? Over 6-8 months now that it's been going strong and, doesn't show any signs. I'm on the original batteries. They actually came with the batteries. So that was even free. It works like a champ. It plugs and play with anything I've thrown at it. It works on my Mac. It's worked under Windows. It works on Linux. Cause it's just a mouse and a keyboard. And did I mention it's $20?
That's a far cry from an Apple keyboard, although I like my Apple keyboard.
Yeah, it's not Bluetooth. It's not, you know, super fancy, but it has one of those tiny little dongles that plugs into a USB port. You don't really notice it's there unless you're on, you know, a Mac where I only have two USB ports on it. But, you know, I predominantly use it with my desktop, and gosh, I love it. And it's $20. It's Logitech MK270. Check it out.
Okay, I'll see your $20 and lower it down to $12. So what I'm talking about is something that this is kind of the first one that I've ever used with any regularity, and that is the Arcadia Tempered Glass Screen Protector. And in this case, it's for my iPhone 6 Plus, and they make them for the normal iPhone 6. They make them for the Samsung Galaxy S4, the Samsung Galaxy S5, a couple other devices as well. And, you know, I've had some screen protectors in the past, and inevitably I always end up pulling it off because it drives me nuts because, you know, it gets dirty. It isn't as easy to run my finger across the screen. I'm telling you what, this thing is like butter, and I love it. The protection angle, I like keeping my devices free of scratches. Scratches are the bane of my existence because I am so absolutely anal about those type of things that it just drives me nuts. So that in and of itself, you know, I like having the protection factor, but I am telling you that this screen protector makes my screen better to use, which is even, you know, that's a win. That's a huge win for me. My finger slides over it better. The fingerprints don't show up as much. There's not as much dust attracted to it. I'm telling you, this thing is awesome, and it's $12. A lot of the competitors that you might find in an AT&T store are going to run you $40, which I cannot. $40 is for a screen protector is just too much. But this is the Arcadia Tempered Glass Screen Protector. I picked it up on Amazon, and again, it was $12, and I love it.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. I have found that the new technology that they've put into the glass makes it just almost impossible to scratch. But, yeah, if you do get a scratch, that's just, it's a sick feeling in your stomach. And I,
yeah, it is for me.
My screen is naked, but, maybe I'll have to look into something like that. That's awesome.
Yep. So you've just listened to another fine episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. If you want to keep up with us, follow us on Twitter at No Better Show. You can also follow me at Jeff Chaney. How about you, Jacob?
You can get me on Twitter at NotTheRealJacob. You can also email me, jacob@nobettershow.com. You can also hit me up on the Google Plus at PlusJCazelle.
And I am also on the Google Plus at PlusJeffChaney. I'm also on Facebook. You can hit me up there. You can email me at Jeff@NoBetterShow. You can also visit our blog at www.NoBetterShow.com. You can participate in the conversation where you will make us have a better show by sending us an email at feedback@NoBetterShow.com. We will read your email, and if we like it, you may even make it on the air and become internet famous. You are welcome. If you did love the show, we would appreciate it if you tell your friends about us. If you subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. iTunes, like it or not, is still the best way for us to get noticed in the podcasting world. If you didn't like us, please don't tell us, because that we're just going to end up in the corner crying. It's going to be ugly. No one wants that. So until next time, thanks for listening to No Better Than Average Podcast.
The chiming and the grandfather clock.
Yeah. The grandmother clock.
Ooh.
Is it an actual, like, 6-foot-tall grandfather clock?
No, it's a grandmother clock, actually.
Okay, educate me. I don't know what a grandmother clock is. Is that a clock that just doesn't work, like, 3 days a month?
No, that's a clock that's smaller than grandfather clock.
How much small? I mean, relative size of clock. Like, the biggest clock I have in my house is a little 8-inch deal that hangs on the wall in the family room.
It's like 5 inches. No, it's 5 feet tall.
Okay, so it's a big old person clock that ticks softly in the night.
In the dawn of time.
I want one of those. I don't know why. As I approach 40, I want a clock that ticks softly.
I was going with the Stonehenge, but in the dawn of time.
In the days of the druid. Oh, that's awesome.